Welcome to Addiction to Recovery. Our purpose and passion is to bring you not only the science of addiction,
but also the patient perspective and how the two relate. Welcome back, everybody, to Addiction to Recovery. My name is Joshua Solem. I am a certified peer recovery specialist. I am joined by my co-host, Dr. Heather Bell, who is a family medical provider and an addiction doctor herself. Hi, Heather.
Hi. I didn't laugh as much during that intro.
No, I think I did all right there. Yeah. We are just blessed to have my guest today, who brings a different viewpoint and actually is working in the field of helping family members. And we haven't really touched on that too much. We've talked about family, we've talked about the different roles that family members play, but we've never really talked much about how much support is out there for families. So we are, go ahead.
I was going to say, because, and this is an area where I think people who are in the addiction world, whether, you know, a loved one or a friend, you know, has the disease of addiction, they probably realize it more, but, you know, the families, not only do they have a role, even if it's peripheral, but they struggle sometimes even more than the person who's actively using, because they're actively using and they're able to escape. And it's always that balance. And I've seen this in clinic 1,000 times of, I don't want to enable, but this is my child and I have 4 kids, so I can't.
Are you with
that? I try to put myself in their shoes, and it can be very challenging. But then there's, unfortunately, not a lot of resources, because unfortunately our society is driven by money, and this is not necessarily even peer support. Just was the ability to, you know, bill for support and services and stuff. So families kind of, it's all, you know, word of mouth, or, you know, random who do you meet, and, you know, the old version of Al-Anon. I've heard mixed reviews, but that was about all there was for a long time.
Right. And this is where I am. And we'll get to you soon here, Pam.
We're just going to talk.
When I went through my CPRS training, I asked, I'm like, where is this for families? I thought this didn't exist. And so now I find out it does. It is peer recovery for family members. And we are joined by Pam Lanhart, who works with the Thrive organization and actually started it. And you have such an interesting look at this. So welcome, Pam. Why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, thank you, Heather and Josh, for inviting me on today. I really appreciate it. And I appreciate the work that you all are doing. I think it, you know, it does take such a concerted effort to really support a person that is struggling. And you'll hear when I speak with person-centered language. I just really believe that these humans that are experiencing a high degree of substance use issues are just human beings. Mm-hmm. And that's really at the core of everything that we do. So, I love your work, and I'm so excited to be here and honored to be part of your program today.
Well, thank you. I'm sorry. I do have a question even before we get to your story. I guess it's a lead in. Prior to the story you're about to tell us, what is your background? You know, were you a school teacher? What was kind of your background? Because, you know, unfortunately in this realm of addiction treatment and recovery work, most people who are making the biggest changes are those who have been personally affected, regardless of what they did in their previous life, if you will.
Right. And part of my story is that I was born into this. Okay. I didn't choose it. It chose me. And the real story is that I was in sales and marketing for years and quit a six-figure job to be a mom. And you'll kind of hear a part of my story. Like, I dark humor, I'll laugh and say that didn't work out that well for me. My story really begins at birth, because I grew up in a family where substance use was prevalent. My dad and mom both struggled with alcohol use issues. Our home, and I didn't have the language until just, you know, 4 or 5 years ago to really be able to articulate this well, but my home was very unsafe. And what that looked like in my family of origin was a lot of arguing, a lot of fighting, a lot of alcohol use around every single social event or social activity that always took a turn, a very dark turn.
Okay.
And so my parents divorced at the time that I was 13. And it was actually a relief. And I feel sometimes a little guilty saying that, but I actually hoped that they would split up because our home was so volatile. And never abusive in the sense that, like, no one ever, like, physically abused me, but it was very emotionally unsafe. Sure. And there was, you know, when you're in this constant state of inconsistency, you know, what's going to happen? My mom, I love my mom. Like, she's 84 and lives close to me, and we have a great relationship now. But at the time, she would show up differently as the 4-H mom or the piano mom or the Sunday school mom. And then in our home, it was an entirely different kind of environment. And so what was interesting, and I didn't realize this until I got into this work, was that when I was 17, we did an intervention on my mom. And back then, it was a treatment center up in northern Minnesota. I'm from the Duluth area. And it was kind of one of the Minnesota model treatment centers. She went in for the assessment with this statement that said, "I'll be back in a day because I'll prove to you that I don't have a problem." Sure. And she came out, you know, 28 days later, and then she worked the 12 steps of AA for years and years and years. And so that is part of my heritage, my family history. My dad unfortunately died from what we think are the effects of his alcoholism when he was just 51 years old. Mm. So that was sort of my first experience with the loss and pain and grief that comes from this disease. Like, the truth is, people die from addiction, right? And he did. And
can I ask a really quick question? Yeah. Then it's interesting that you say, you know, you had almost like two versions of your mom. My grandfather, who was my favorite human in the entire world, who, you know, passed away a few years ago at almost 90, he had an alcohol use disorder, although that had been, he was in recovery from the time I was born. So I never knew that version of him. However, he was a violent person when he drank, and that's why my grandparents divorced, because he was physically violent. And it was interesting to watch the dynamic between my mom and her two sisters and their interactions with him, and just how that changed, like, the rest of their relationship, because they were all, like, right around 20 when they divorced, and versus my relationship with my grandpa and the grandpa I knew. You know, I got the better version in all essence, you know, all, you know, intents and purposes. And so what was your kind of relationship then from, you know, 13, obviously, if you did the intervention at age 17, but you had this relief when they were divorced. What was that time, though, like between 13 and 17 when she was still drinking?
It was confusing.
Okay.
And difficult. And my mom sort of fell into, you know, it's called the Cartman drama triangle, and she definitely took on the role of victim. Mm-hmm. You know, poor me, my husband left me, and she spent a lot of time mitigating that pain at the local VFW, right? Gotcha. And what that looked like for me was not having a parent. I parented myself. That looked like being afraid when she was drinking, because she would do things like, "Let's step on the gas and see how fast this car will go." And I think, you know, a lot of the things that I experienced, I couldn't, again, articulate or verbalize until I had done a whole lot of work around my family generational trauma. And, you know, what I will say is that we pass on trauma, we pass on negative generational patterns, but we also pass on certain strengths as well. Exactly. And so what came out of that for me from the perspective of strengths and, you know, the things that were passed down generationally that I can say I'm super grateful for would be resilience, determination. The way I manifested this was being very goal oriented. And like, for me, accomplishments equaled love. Now, of course, now, you know, I had to do some work around that, right? Because exactly. As you become an adult, you're like, yeah, this isn't necessarily always super healthy. If my identity is in, you know, my achievements, or I equate love to my accomplishments, I never really truly understand this idea of unconditional, you know, radical love. And so there was a lot of work that I had to do as an adult around that, but there was definitely difficult times through all of that. And my older brother and sister were gone out of the house. So it was me and my younger brother and sister. We were, you know, 13, 12, and 11 when my parents got divorced. And, you know, we essentially parented ourselves for those teenage years until my mom finally got the help that she needed. And then, so here's the interesting part of the story, kind of going back to your grandfather, is that she was sober for probably, I don't know, over, I'm trying to think, maybe 40 years. Now I'm 35 years. And she decided that she was going to start drinking again.
Wow.
Now, what's interesting about that is that she can have a glass of wine or two and not, you know, it's not out of control. She's 84. But the response, my response to that and my nieces and nephews and kids' response are two different things. Yeah. So they didn't have the experience of living with, you know, the behaviors of my mom's disease. So for me, it's like super, super triggering. But for them, it's no big deal. Oh, come on, live and let live. Let grandma have some fun. And I'm like, you have no idea what we went through because of my mother's drinking. And even if she can manage it now at 84 years old, I can't be around it. So I set some really strong boundaries with my mom that, like, I can't tell you whether you should drink or not drink, but I am not going to be around this because it really activates me. And as much as I try to control that, the minute she starts getting loud or acting, you know, like a 17-year-old, I'm like, okay, I'm out.
I'm out.
Like, I'm tapping out. Oh. Right?
And I could ask, like, I mean, we're not going to go down this road, but I could ask a million questions because, I mean, maybe you and your mom have had these conversations, and that can be another conversation or offline about her processing of that, because I do find it interesting the people who can have one and, you know, almost that harm reduction type situation. I wouldn't necessarily call that of this, but people who can have one and they are totally fine regardless of what happened in the past, and then how much processing she had to do, you know, whether in treatment or during those 35 years. And, you know, unpacking that root cause. You know, we spent one of our recent podcasts talking about the root cause of the addiction and really doing the dive on that and to see kind of where she felt her root cause was and how that impacts her now ability to have one or two and stop. But we can.
Yeah, and I could definitely speculate on all of that. And you're right. That's like an hour-long conversation.
Right.
What I will say as a podcast for people in recovery is I don't recommend it, right?
Me either.
I mean, that, you know, the big book talks about the true addict, and I don't like using that language, but I think they're, you know, my son and my dad and my sister, like, they fall into that category. And I do think there are some people get addicted to, say, fentanyl, and they get into recovery and maybe they can manage a drink every once in a while. But you're playing with fire at that point. And my feeling is like, you know, there's a lot of people. In fact, I just had somebody who had a return to use after over 5 years of continuous sobriety because they just wanted to see, you know, one time that they could handle alcohol and they were off and running. Yeah. So, you know, for the sake of your listeners, like I can't advocate for that. I mean, I think there are certain people that were sort of predestined to, you know, have this, and you know, epigenetics, right? Like, I don't, there's a lot of arguments whether there's really a connected gene to addiction, but you know, what we do know is there are certain people that you could look at them and say that that switch was flipped the minute they use the very first time. And like they literally, it doesn't matter what's put in front of them. They will use it and use it to excess. And that is in their DNA. Right. Yeah. And that would be the story for my dad who had tons of generational trauma. I mean, his story's crazy. Like his dad ran liquor during Prohibition. His dad died when my dad was 18 months. His stepdad walked out on him when he was 10, went to get milk one day and never came home, you know. And then I've got, we have three of my siblings are in recovery, but one for sure, well, two of them really had a lot of trauma because of my dad. And of course, like now I can look at that and I can say he literally just was trying to survive. And, you know, he just had the deck stacked against him. I kind of feel like maybe he had undiagnosed, because they didn't diagnose it back then, like bipolar, and my sister is on medications now for, you know, mental health issues. And I kind of think my son maybe they were starting to get into that possible diagnosis. So, you know, you're right. Like our philosophy at Thrive is what's behind the use, and there's always a why. And when we think about it as the substances are not the problem, they're never the problem. They're always the solution, right? And so there's always something underlying. And maybe it's a false belief, or maybe like in my son's case, I think, you know, he was definitely ADHD, kind of a naughty boy, you know, and not knowing any better. I'm sure that I put labels on him at the time, or maybe he just innately felt like he didn't fit in or something was wrong. And there's always, you ask anybody in addiction and they will always tell you, you know, I just, like, and maybe it's not a big T trauma. Not everybody who struggles with substance use had a huge traumatic event. It could be simple things like, I just never felt like I fit in, you know? Mm-hmm. Or you hear about people that are like empaths and they end up with addictions and they're like, I just felt everything.
It's so, you know, Pam, acutely. It's so funny you mentioned like all of that. We actually were today talking about big T traumas, and because there's new articles on gender differences, and that'll be a different podcast. But we were talking about the big T traumas, and we've talked about, or at least touched on, after my I worked in a jail for a year, and seeing the basic three different types of people who use methamphetamines, and one of the, well, one of them's ADHD undiagnosed or, you know, self-treated, and one of them is kind of that empath. That's a huge chunk of them. I mean, those two probably make up 90% of patients I have personally seen who, especially with methamphetamines. And so I just think it's fascinating that the words you are saying are parallel to things we have said, or that, you know, our beliefs that we've had for years.
Well, and I think that's, I mean, once I talked to you the first time, I think that we both kind of saw that we had very similar ideology on this, and that's why I was so excited to have you on and talk to you even more. But getting back to the story, and I, you know, you did mention you have three siblings in recovery. Did you ever experience any issues with alcohol, drugs, anything like that?
You know, interestingly, no. And this is where sometimes I just think life feels very random and unpredictable, because we had 5 kids in our family and 3 are in recovery. And, you know, I was one of those people that could drink, like, in the world of substance use, they call them normies, mm-hmm. right? Where, you know, I did experiment with alcohol and marijuana back in, I mean, I grew up in the 70s, so it was buds that had 7% THC at the time.
Yeah.
But, you know, I drank, and I could drink a lot, and the next day I had no desire to drink. Right.
Sure.
So, but I think being an adult child of parents that had substance use issues, I think anybody that grows up in that environment has trauma. And I think that, you know, the way my trauma manifested was just, it just looked prettier. Right. Mm-hmm. So the manifestation of quote unquote my addictions were body dysmorphia, were restrictive eating, over exercising, you know, achievements, as I mentioned. So, you know, I like to challenge family members that no one gets out of life unscathed, and we absolutely 1000% all have stuff that we've got to figure out and work through. And, you know, I've been blessed to have good therapists and to have been able to do a lot of really deep trauma work, and mine just looked different. You know, why in the world I got the roll of the, I got the stick that wasn't the short stick, and I can drink without, no, I don't drink. I just want to say I choose to be sober, and I made that choice early on in my son's recovery as a way to support him. And, you know, someone said to me one time, when I've ever met anybody that can take it or leave it, they take it every time. You know, and so we live in this society where substance use is glamorized and celebrated, and everything is about, you know, mommy cocktails and, you know, having beer at the lake, and everything is centered around, yeah, substance use. And then when somebody gets ill from it, they're shamed for having the disease. And it's like, you know, I can say truly, that is not anybody's fault. That's a roll of the freaking dice.
Because exactly.
I could have been completely vulnerable to having an addiction, and why I didn't, I will never be able to figure that one out. And that's the hardest thing about the suffering of addiction, is that there sometimes it is unpredictable. And as you'll hear in the rest of my story, sometimes there is no real rhyme or reason to it. And, you know, I don't know. I don't know why it didn't happen for me, but I'm grateful. And I do think that we can be, as people who can manage our alcohol or our substance use, most people become very, very intolerant and judgmental about that.
Yeah.
Well, I grew up the same way as they did, and I can handle my alcohol, or, you know, I drink, and I just know when to stop. And so that's part of the problem of this idea of choice, you know?
Right.
And,
yeah.
And the way I reframe it is, you know, obviously it's not a choice, because I didn't have a problem, and they did, and we drank the same. Like, you know, I chose to drink just like they did. I chose to smoke marijuana just like my siblings did. I've had 21 different surgeries and been prescribed opiates so much, and never struggled with stopping them. So, like, is that a choice then? No.
No.
Right? Yeah, so we always kind of say in our work, it's like choice, no choice, choice. So, like, everybody chooses to use. I mean, I don't know too many people. I've met maybe one or two in my life that haven't used alcohol. It becomes a problem. I don't think that's a choice. Addiction is never a choice. But I do think that there's a certain element of willingness and choice that comes into getting into recovery. And I think that's one of the things that we love about our work with the families, is that we can create the conditions in a family system that will shut down change, or that will help create conditions that support change. And so when we get into these ideologies of, well, there's nothing we can do, I don't agree with that, because I think that we are not powerless and there are a thousand things that we can do. And that as someone sort of starts to move through those stages of change and you start to hear some, you know, language around maybe wanting to make a change, how we respond as a family member and support system to that person can actually build more willingness, or it can completely shut it down. And, you know, part of my message is that the way that Americans have been conditioned to deal with substance use over the years is to be confrontational and to really almost perpetuate the conditions that support continued use, because they shut that stuff down so quickly, you know, and they shame and they blame. And they don't mean to. Like, I didn't ever mean to shame my son, but that's sort of what they're being told. Mm-hmm. And they're, you know, they're being guided with these sound bites through, you know, crowdsourcing, right? Oh, just let go. There's nothing you can do, you know. They have to be ready, all these different things. And they're not well-defined. They're not rooted in evidence. You know, they're all just mantras or trite phrases that are causing harm to people that are using substances.
Yeah.
And so that's really the root of my work, is to, you know, just sort of deconstruct some of that old ideology.
Yeah. And just quickly, I think you and Heather could become best friends really fast after hearing your story. I mean, Heather's going like, this is me.
You just described me to a T in terms of, well, listen to episode 32 and you're going to laugh the whole way through. You're going to think it's you speaking.
I think you guys are going to be like best friends when texting back and forth. And, I love it.
I'm up for it.
That's awesome. So, yeah. I mean, well, not that eating disorders are fun, but it's
a real thing.
It's own beast, yeah. But yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and again, like, we all have stuff and it just manifests differently. And, you know, I'll get back to my story in a second, but one of the things that we always do when we start working with a family is to help them understand more about the disease and to come at this from a place of understanding. We have to put ourselves in other people's shoes. Like, that's what empathy is, you know, really about. And when I, you know, look at my own life and I'm like, I'm really not that much different. Mine just looks different, right? It's not as harmful to other people, maybe. So, you know, it's prettier, right? Mm-hmm. But it's there. And I mean, I brought that trauma into my family. So kind of going back to the story. So, you know, we knew, like, we had done some of this work, because of course my mom had been through treatment, and then I was, you know, I worked for like Dale Carnegie Training for a while, and I was in sales, and, you know, a lot of it is self-help and, you know, being able to be more positive and whatever. But, you know, so in many ways I thought, this generational pattern's breaking with us. You know, I was naive enough to think that I had something to do with breaking that pattern. Mm-hmm.
You know? Now, does your husband have similar, does he have this in his background or something? And you don't need to go into his story, but I'm just curious because, you know, obviously there's two people that bring the same, you know, different traumas into their kids.
Right. Well, we kind of laugh and say, like, he is the white sheep of his dad was the white sheep of his family. And so, like, on his dad's side, there's a whole historical, you know, prison, alcoholism, you know, people dying from their addictions. So, like, there's a lot on his side of the family, but his family was like Warden June Cleaver. You know, they were just like, yep, very sweet, very good, you know, it was a, he grew up in a very different environment, but okay, so this is where generational patterns come in and how we have to fight to break these generational patterns. They had good cop, bad cop in their family. And the mom was, you know, the one that sort of ruled the roost and disciplined and controlled things. And he adored his dad. Like, his dad was just, he's the most likable person in the world. And there are many things we loved about his mom too, but we, then when my son started presenting with symptoms, you know, guess what role we fell into, you know, which was good cop, bad cop, right? So he took a step back and just always sort of was the nice guy in all of this. And I ended up sort of being the bad guy. And, you know, again, like, these are things that I don't speak of them in a shaming way, or I don't feel any shame in that anymore, because that's just the way it played out. We didn't know what we didn't know. And so when I speak to families, and I want to speak this out there right now, like, if you recognize yourself in any of these things that we're talking about today, the last thing I would want to do is make anyone feel guilty or feel shame. This is my experience, and I think that we, again, like, there's a conditioning in society, so that's part of how people learn to walk through this, but also that we do the best that we do, and we don't know what we don't know. So just like my parents, we brought in some good qualities and good characteristics. I mean, my husband and I have been married for 42 years. I met him in high school, so we've been together 46 and a half years. He brought stability into our family. He brought consistency into a family where I was less consistent with, you know, I kind of took on a little bit of my mom's behaviors, like very reactive, very overreactive. What person is going to show up today? Is it going to be the loving, snuggling, awesome mom, or is it going to be the one that's going to lose her shit because, you know, you left dishes in the sink, right? So, like, I didn't really even understand, like, that part of the trauma, which is that there's a lot of research around how inconsistency can cause trauma, you know? And, like, for me, I think that was part of how I passed on that generational trauma, was just being very inconsistent. You know, one minute I'm happy-go-lucky, smiling, laughing, fun. Let's read, let's snuggle. And the next minute I'm like, who didn't clean up their mess? And I think that that even in and of itself can cause trauma, right?
Well, it's that inconsistency of not knowing which person's going to show up. You know, it's like you're on edge. You're walking on, you know, glass, just trying to tiptoe around what it could be. And then, you know, like you said, that can lead to trauma because it's always ingrained in you.
Just and what did I just say about my mom? Yeah. And you know, it's, isn't it interesting that I, even as much as I knew, I still fell into a similar pattern that my mom had. And it wasn't until about 7 years ago that somebody, like, pointed that out to me. And I was like, ooh, okay, that was hard to hear, but you're right.
Right.
Yeah. You know? And so a lot of my personal work has been to be intentional and show up consistently, you know? Yeah. And am I perfect? No, I can still fight being reactive, but I take a step back. I've developed some tools in my tool belt so that I can be, you know, I can't tell you how many times I'm like, I'm shooting off this email and I'm pissed off and I'm going to, I'm going to send them that text. And then I'm like, okay, pause.
We are so related.
Yeah.
take some time and, like, maybe don't hit the send button. And I've learned to not hit that send button. And then I'll come back to it a few hours later. And I'm like, ooh, that is not how I want to be.
Exactly.
Which is part of the work that we do with families is, you know, this idea of intention.
Yes.
Like, we don't tell people what to do, but we always give them all the perspectives and say, whatever you decide you're going to do, do it with compassion, do it with empathy, and do it with intention, so that you're not just overreacting and you're going to regret, you know, all these different things down the road. So,
well, yeah. That, that, so, It's very interesting to, you know, because I know Heather well, and I, you know, and I'm hearing all this stuff and I'm seeing her reactions. And again, it would be nice to be on video because you could see her reactions, but it, you know, it is, it's very interesting to know that this is a very common thing, and people listening are probably doing the same thing Heather's doing, you know, mm-hmm. pointing at themselves going, this is me. I find that just so fascinating. So I think that could be a podcast in and of itself.
Yeah, I love the mom. The mom timeout is like,
and it's very educational, because I think that you're coming on and saying that you are well aware of this and you have made some changes in your life, and I think that a lot of people could benefit from that. Unfortunately, that's not the, you know, we're not going to go down that road yet, but I do want to bring it back to your son now. Jacob, this is kind of, this whole thing that you've started is kind of, would you say that the inspiration was his struggle?
Oh yeah. Oh, 100%. I remember 10 years ago thinking, what am I going to do with my life? You know, and in the 12 steps, it's interesting because they'll say, I'm here because my higher power cleared a path for me to walk through it. And that's exactly what I would say. This wasn't even a decision. This was just, the path was cleared and I said, yes, I'm walking through it. So going back to the family, we have four children. Our oldest daughter is 39 now. And I always tell this, she has 10 children. In the family system, everybody would say, oh yeah, she was the hero, the golden child, you know, she was just the easy one. And then I had, we had 11 years before we had our next one because I was working full time. And part of the story is how wanted they were, that I quit a six-figure job to stay at home with my kids. And we waited all those years to have them until we were kind of in a position for me to not have to work. And so we made a lot of decisions and choices that were very intentional about me being able to stay home. And actually we lived in poverty, but we were willing to do that because I really felt like it was super important for me to be home with those three kids that were born after that. So our kids were very wanted. They were all planned. And we had Andy, who's now 27, Jacob, who would be 26, and Nikki, who's 23. And so, you know, we were so intentional, like many people on this call. And it just, you know, it's like, oh gosh, if good parenting prevented addiction, you know, we would have the solution, right? Mm-hmm. Or if bad parenting caused addiction, we could figure that one out. But the truth is, there's no predictability to the disease of addiction. So we raised these three kids, and you know, I often say we checked all those parenting boxes. We're definitely outdoor adventurous. And in fact, my husband has a nonprofit and we bring people in recovery out to do wilderness adventures, Colorado trips and boundary waters. So our family culture was outdoors, adventure, high risk taking activities that, you know, both my husband and I, he's a quiet one, but he will surprise you with, like, he's a risk taker. And, you know, so like our kids, we kind of had this balance of like, okay, they did youth group in church and they did pro-social activities. And in fact, we let them play rugby because, like, you know, soccer was too boring for some of our kids. So, you know, we were not those kind of parents that were overprotective. In fact, we were like, hey, we'll do it with you, right?
Right.
And then we had all those other, you know, how they always say, oh, you, if you eat, how can you prevent addiction with your kids? Just eat five meals a week together with them. Like it would be that simple.
Right.
Right. Or just take them camping, or, you know, watch over them and make sure that they, you know, they're not overexposed, but you can't be too, naive. You know, restrictive either, right? Yeah. You know, so like we read all the parenting books, did all the parenting courses, did the best that we could. But when my son was 13 years old, we got a call from school that he had brought a backpack full of pills to school. And they
what
were
was
like,
the first
oh my gosh.
Thought that went through your head when you got that phone call? Because I got a phone call a couple years ago that my son had taken like some powdery you know, juice mix or drink mix, you know, like Powerade powder. And it was like the end of the world for the school. He goes to a Catholic school, so that makes a little more sense. But like, you still are like, well, we caught Isaac with some type of, you know, substance. We didn't know what it was. And it was like, oh my gosh, okay, here we go. But so what was that phone call like?
Well, so we had seen some signs. So, you know, a few months before that, he had stolen a jacket. He was like, I could see him. Sometimes I would check on him and he wouldn't be in his bed. He'd be outside smoking a cigarette. So like, we kind of started, we knew that there were some problems, right? Mm-hmm. And he was super drawn to like high risky boys, you know, even though there were many great boys that liked him and he was very well liked. He was starting to change his friend group, hanging around with kids that, you know, we thought were like bad kids, which are laughable now because, mm-hmm. you know, he ended up being the bad kid that everybody wanted to stay away from. So we weren't surprised completely. We had started to see some signs that he was really struggling. And, you know, it was at the time it was old pharmaceuticals that had been in my medicine cabinet. So, you know, people, if you're listening, get rid of your old pills, lock them up, or, you know, turn them in because, like, you know, you don't know what you don't know. And by the time you figure it out, it's too late, right? Mm-hmm. They've already been. So he, you know, this, he had gone into seventh grade and the way we responded to this was like anybody, oh, well, we need to get him more involved in like, you know, so we signed him up for MMA at the gym and we started mountain biking with him. And, you know, we're like, the typical response is shut down their phone and get them busier. And I think that's a pretty normal response. But, of course, it didn't stop anything. And so by the time he's 15, and he was always drawn to, like, you know, watching shows like Breaking Bad. And sometimes I'm like, oh, crap, if we went to let him watch that show, maybe he wouldn't have kept using, you know, you think things like mm-hmm. that. So I'll never forget, and this, you know, this was probably the biggest intervention was my daughter came up one day with all my good jewelry, and she's like, hey, if you don't want this, can I have it? And I'm like, what are you talking about? It's like all my, like at that point in time, I had some valuable jewelry, and my son had stolen it out of the bedroom. He was going to sell it. And I did my typical way overreaction, but I said, there, you know, there's an elephant in the room. There, we have an addict in our house, and if he doesn't get help, I'm not coming home. And I left. Like, it was way, I would not recommend that now today, but that was how I, that's all I knew back then. So he went into his first treatment program at 15. By 16, he was escalating his use, and he ended up in a treatment court program in our county, in Dakota County. And we learned the first concepts of like a community wrap team, which stands for Wellness Recovery Action Plan. So we got this very interesting model of like compassion and empathy and wrapping him up with a whole team, you know, so he like had a therapist and a mentor and a probation officer. And we were all mobilized. There was about seven of us on this team to, you know, help him get through this drug court program. And that really got me thinking. And then the other thing that happened, which was super critical to me starting this organization, was that two things happened. One was when we went through the family program, which they don't even have now, at the treatment center that he was at, and we got actual education and we got actual helpful information. And at the time I thought, why do we have to wait until your loved one gets into treatment to become educated on the disease of addiction?
Right.
Right? Like, we were just told, go to a meeting, go to a meeting, go to a meeting. And the only meeting out there was a 12-step meeting, and I went to many of them, and I felt like it caused harm. You know, like, I wasn't going to call my 15-year-old an addict. Like, and I wasn't going to call him a qualifier. And I wasn't going to try to confront him out of denial. And all these things just didn't feel right. But I didn't have different tools and skills at the time. Well, as he's going through this treatment court program, everybody is, and I'll just tell this little bit, is that then my youngest daughter started self-harming. And that was rooted in that whole trauma and chaos and what was going on in her family. And we were referred to DBT and dialectical behavioral therapy were these actionable solutions, right? So I'm like, oh my gosh, there's ways to manage behaviors and to communicate differently and to get good information. And why are families not being directed to that rather than just one type of recovery that, you know, I didn't feel was very helpful at the time, mm-hmm. right?
And
so that was sort of when the wheels started churning about how are families really, really being supported? Because I think if I would have had the tools and the skills and the guidance that I'm giving families now, it's possible, like, something could have really change earlier, and it may not have led to the progression of the disease, right?
So in your bio or in that story that's on your website, you mentioned, I'm just going to read a little blurb from it. It says, between the predatory practices of treatment centers and the propaganda of the tough love ideology, she and her husband Paul felt that they were failing their son. Can you talk about that, the predatory
propaganda treatment
center? Those types of words to describe some of the things that you were experiencing?
Well, I think that treatment centers, by and large, don't want people to get well because there's no money in it.
Mm. It's a good, I mean, I've thought of that many times. Trust me, nine times in there, I'm going, I'm not seeing any change here.
Right. So they don't help families. Why would they help a family? Yeah. Because there's a ripple effect. And if a family member starts getting well, it might actually help the person get well. And there's no money in that.
That's the scary right? part. That's the real scary yeah. part about this whole epidemic is that there's a
and
lot
the
of money in
system of
it.
Care.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I saw, you know, people going into treatment centers and, you know, the treatment centers were actually causing further harm by saying things like, well, if that was my mom, I'd want to use too. And so they're not engaging the family. You know, they're not helping the family, the entire family system. And then there's other predatory practices like body brokering that goes on where, you know, a treatment center just like, you know, runs them through detox and residential, causes them to relapse, puts them back in detox residential. You know, so there are, believe it or not, there's a lot of people in the industry and there are really good people in the industry. And I need to caveat that because there are genuine people that want to help, but there's a lot of people that don't want to help. And so, you know, so part of my mission was to educate families on, you know, what proper treatment looks like and what they should be involved in and how they should be involved. And if you've got a treatment center that's not involving the family, they're probably not the best program, you know. So I saw some of those practices and I saw people going down to Florida and dying, mm-hmm. you know, and their parents were just desperate to get them help and they were being preyed upon by, you know, what they call patient brokers, which that's another whole episode for another time, you know, but like, I just felt like families weren't really getting supported and they weren't getting evidence-based information and help. And that was the precipice, you know, and this harmful ideology of cut them off, kick them out, confront, tough love, they have to hit rock bottom. Well, you know, for today, rock bottom is death
exactly.
for over 350 people today. So like there, you know, the 12-step ideology, bless their hearts, is still not supporting harm reduction. And, you know, we've got people dying from fentanyl every single day and they're being told that you're not really sober if you're on medications. And so like in our work and in the groups that we provide, and we're starting a group up in Brainerd coming up here in January, Like, you are, come as you are welcome. If your pathway is, you know, if your loved one's pathway is Suboxone, we'll support that. If they're on the streets, we want to make sure they get naloxone and sterile needles. And, you know, for a long time, I was just indoctrinated in this idea that if my son wasn't completely abstinent, that he wasn't really in recovery until he got addicted to meth and heroin and then IV meth and heroin. And at that point, you know, you're like, I'll support any pathway for recovery, because if I don't, he's going to die.
Right.
Right. And so, you know, I think that's part of my mission. Again, when I talk about how do we deconstruct the conditioning of our society, my church said, cut him off. You know, the meetings I went to said, he's an addict. Every bit of advice that I got for the first 4 or 5 years of this journey was advice that created conflict and division and disconnection between my son and myself. And had I been equipped with the ideology, with the idea, just even someone saying, no, like, you can still connect with your person. You can be kind and compassionate. You can support them even though they're struggling. Like, this isn't, someone said one time, there's a huge distance between all and nothing, you know? And in those early years, we were in that all or nothing, black and white thinking, and it caused harm. Mm-hmm. It caused harm to our family and to our relationship. And when you look at our guiding principles on our website, they are all about not doing harm, you know? So at the very least, you know, they always say, if you can't say something nice, don't say anything at all. So at the very least, we can help families to not perpetuate shame, blame, stigma, and harm. And then what we do is we take the family member and equip them with the tools and the skills to actually help support change, willingness, and recovery, right?
So at what point did this really then, I don't say click, but when did this really kind of evolve then for your family and with Jake? Because it, you know, it says obviously the many years of recovery. How did that evolve and get to that point? What did that look like?
So, he was 17 and he was out of our house for a little while and he wanted to come home, and we were contemplating whether or not to allow him to come home. And the universe just converged to create this perfect moment. And at the time I was reading a book called The Anatomy of Peace, which is all about stepping out of dehumanizing people and how we create power differentials in relationships. And I was reading a lot of Brene Brown's work on compassion and empathy, and her book Braving the Wilderness, which is how we put people in broad brush categories and we file people into those people and others. And I was sitting in front of a pastor and asking, like, do we do this? And he looked at us and he said, are you going to be right for the sake of justice, or are you going to love for the sake of relationship? Because love never fails.
Yeah, we've heard that message many times. Mm-hmm. We've got a mantra of love wins.
Yeah, like, are you going to be right? Are you going to love right? And at the time, this thought, you know, came into my head, and I asked myself these three questions. And one was, if my son got well, would he want to have a relationship with me?
Ooh, that's a,
and the second was,
good thought.
Yeah. And then the second one was, if my son got well, would he want to have a relationship with the God that I claim to represent? Right. So that was a big motivator for me, was I walking out love, because the God I believed in was a God of love. And then the third part of that story was, and if he didn't make it, would I have regrets? Mm-hmm. What would the last interaction I had with my son be? would it have been, would he have seen compassion and love in my eyes? Would the last text he read have been, you know, confrontational? And I saw people losing their loved ones, and they were losing their lives along with them because they were so beside themselves, because the last, you know, interaction they had was yelling and screaming and kicking them out by their shirt tails or whatever, you know. And I was like, good God. And I knew people that were dying from this disease, and it was a motivator for me, honestly. Mm-hmm. I was like, you know, what if he doesn't make it out? I don't want to be losing my life and be so consumed by the regrets and the what ifs that I couldn't move forward.
Well, it would be like you wouldn't be able to get well after the fact because of those regrets. And I, you know, and my personal experience is that my family went through something similar where they were given some advice about tough love, and you know, it was like cut me off and all that stuff. And then as they progressed, they ended up getting, you know, counseled by a friend of mine, and that led to those texts that you're talking about, the we love you, we care about you, nothing demeaning, nothing, you know, confrontational. It was just all about love. And I can tell you that that saved my life. There was times where I wanted to end my life, and I would get a text message like that, and I thought, I can't do it. I can't do it to them because they care about me so much. So I think that that's a great thing to share with people, and we have. But for you to, you know, you put it in a better way than I do. So
I mean, we're going to need to wrap up sometime here soon, but did Jake make any comments about kind of that evolution that then led to his recovery? Like, was he able to articulate to you all what that felt like to him? Because obviously he's the one that went through this, go to this treatment and hear these things and, you know, from society. And then when you were able to kind of shift this mindset, was he able to say something to that kind of helped really solidify this idea and this passion of yours?
Yeah. So we went ahead and started our nonprofit and started doing this work. And, you know, I think families have expectations, and expectations can cause resentments. And so we had really let go of the idea of amends, you know, that we felt like when he was ready, like he would, right, you know, he would make an amend. And he was young when he started using, and he was only 19 when he started his recovery
journey.
So, you know, I think that the more immature they are, the harder that concept of amends really is. So he was from 2019 until 2021, he was mostly in recovery, but he did have a return to use. He went to a wilderness treatment center, and all we could do was write letters. And we have these beautiful, beautiful letters from our son that just rip your heart out today when I look back. But they were, you know, thank you for standing by me. I wouldn't be where I am today without you. I appreciate everything you did for me. Of course, he knew that I was pretty well connected in the you know, world of treatment. So that did help us, mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, when it came to making sure that he got help. He was on Suboxone for a while, and that actually allowed him to do the very, very best that he ever did. And he had some really solid recovery time from it would have been like October 2018 until April of 2021, and he did have, you know, a pretty bad, and in the past when he ever had a relapse, it was sort of, there was a little trajectory, right, which was, oh, he's smoking pot, and then he's drinking alcohol, which if he were here today, he'd probably say alcohol was really his, you know, drug of choice, so to speak. Because that always led him to everything else. But in April of 2021, it was from 0 to 1,000. Like mm-hmm. he went from not using to stopping at Suboxone to using IV, everything in a matter of days. And so we thought, he loved the outdoors. He was living in Colorado. And we thought, oh, maybe this wilderness program that, by the way, used the anatomy of peace as their tax. And I'm like, maybe they can get through to him, because we were still getting some feedback that he just really was struggling with feeling the emotions and not, you know, using to numb himself. So he did this 90-day treatment program in Utah, came back to Colorado and was on Vivitrol. Because we just thought maybe that would be more effective for him, right? So he was 6 months out of that treatment program, and on the night of October 20th, we got a message saying, you know, that his IOP program, he had left, pulled his ROI, and that he was going back out with a friend of his. And actually, that was the 21st. And he died in the early morning hours of October 23rd of 2021. So his return to use was very, obviously very severe, very consequential. The irony of it all was that the person that he was using with overdosed the night that Jake died, and he saved him. You know, he saved him with naloxone, and they got him a bed in detox. He brought him to the hospital, took care of his friend, came back home to his apartment, and used one last time.
So I'm just assuming he didn't get his Vivitrol shot somewhere recently prior to that.
He was on oral naltrexone.
Oh, he was. Okay.
Yeah. And so when he went back out, I asked, like, we were communicating, and, you know, I do have all those text messages, and I do have the, you know, comfort of how we walked through this. We had all agreed there wasn't going to be any triangulation. Everybody was going to communicate on the up and up. There was no shame or blame, but we were being honest. So the first thing we did was call this girlfriend who he lived with and, you know, spoke with her, and we're like, you know, we've got to keep an eye on this. And he was pretty good at framing it like he was helping his friend. I wasn't really super worried about him. And that night, in fact, my husband was on one of his adventure trips, and I was at a concert that Friday night and had no idea what was happening. But he had stopped taking his oral naltrexone probably the end of September, and we didn't know it.
Gotcha.
He, you know, looking back, he was probably in a mental relapse already at that point. And, you know, we were in touch and communicating, and he had a really honest relationship with his Maddie, his partner. But, you know, as the case is, addiction is insidious. And it's manipulative, and we didn't have the whole picture. So he, you know, he passed away probably in the early morning hours of October 23rd, 2021. And I know we're going to have to wrap this up, and we're going to have to do another podcast.
Yes.
But what I will say is, and we use recovery-oriented language, right? So because of my personal recovery, the work that we did, the healing that we did, the engagement with Jake, I mean, and he climbed mountains. We all started climbing mountains because of him, and so we're still climbing. We still go out there. I am still standing today and able to have these conversations and continue to do this work because I know that it worked in our family, even though the outcome wasn't, you know, what we would have liked. I can tell you that I have the letters, I have the text messages, that I can sleep at night knowing that we didn't do anything in those last months and years that we can't live with. And just yesterday morning, I was scrolling through his old text messages, and they were from like 2019 and 2020. And I'm like, damn, like I was a pretty good communicator. I had some skills, you know? And like, I feel like that's what I have left, is that assurance that, you know, we had done the repair work and we had really done a lot of work. And, you know, this effing disease is tough to beat. And I think it's really hard with fentanyl, you know, on the streets right now. And he knew it. Like, he wrote us and he's like, I know that if I use again, I'll die. He wrote that in his letter. Yeah. It's, for me, it's either recovery or death.
Right.
And, you know, why he chose to go back out, we'll never know the answer to that. We know he didn't want to die. We also know that the night that he did, he looked at his friend. His friend told him to throw some of his stuff away. And he said, oh, don't worry about me. I know how to use safely. And his levels of drugs in his system were very low. Like, they were non-toxic levels for the most part, but he had not used. He was completely abstinent
for
a really long time. So he had no tolerance. And I'm sure that day he had mates. And, you know, anyway, so I share that all because in his, when I posted on Facebook that day, what I said was, the work that I do has never been about outcomes, right? Like, it's always been about the what ifs and what can I live with and how can I walk through this so that I can sleep at night, so that I'm not constantly activated, so that I have a relationship with my loved one, because the data supports that it is connection and relationship that creates change. And I can honestly, with no hesitation, say that we had gotten there.
Yeah.
Like with cancer, you know, some people are at stage 4 and they don't make it.
Right. I've been lucky with, I should say lucky, I've had very good outcomes with certain patients, and yet I've seen parents who, you know, we haven't. And it's definitely just like, there's a full spectrum of parents or loved ones or support system as someone is trying to, you know, navigate their recovery journey. There's so many different outcomes when it comes to the survivor's guilt or the survivors of this disease with their loved one. And I think it is just so, you know, what you ended with there with the, you know, you can look back and, you know, really know in your heart and soul that even though Jake passed, he knew he was loved and you knew you had done everything to show that love, and that can bring peace. That's, I think that's huge, because there's just so many who aren't there, and that's got to be just.
And this is what is important about this topic, is that what you said, it's not about the outcomes, because the outcomes are so widespread, you know,
cancer, you know, there's just sometimes the disease, it will win.
You can't look back. And this is why, like, my family had a hard time. My dad especially was thinking about things that he did that caused it. And that's the problem is that even in that recovery, that, you know, you're doing what you're doing and you're trying to help the person. It's not about the outcome. It's about the process. And what you're, and like you said, if it's about the outcome, you're going to be left with regrets, you know, and then it's about winning and losing. And this is not about winning or losing. This is about caring and loving. And so I really appreciate what you're doing. And I really think that there's so much more we are going to get to next time we have you on. Is there any last words you'd like to leave us with?
Well, you know, Josh, you said it earlier, and I'll just say this really quick. you can't do your work after death. You got to do it before, you know? And so you're, the reason why I can talk about this today is because I did my work, right? Mm-hmm. And families have work to do. It's not just, it's not on the individual, and it's not only the individual's responsibility to do their work. And there's so much work a family member can and should be doing through this process. And so I really appreciate that. Like, we don't know the outcomes, but we can do the work, and that work will produce, you know, life, basically, is, you know, we want to help families live through their loved ones' addictions and model this healthy behavior, and then knowing that that does have a ripple effect and it does impact outcomes. So that, thank you for having me today. It's been really wonderful. Yeah,
we really appreciate it. And I just want to give you a quick plug. Your website is thrivefamilyrecoveryresources.org. And there's a lot of good information on there. There's a way to get a hold of you. We will also put that on our social media so that people that are reaching out to us have the information right there. So thank you very much. And we are going to set something up, you know, off the call about when you can come on next. So thank you so much, Pam.
Well, thank you guys, Heather and Josh. I really appreciate it. And I can't wait to connect again.
Sounds good. Thank you, Pam.
Working together, we can move addiction to recovery.
If you would be so kind, please go to wherever you listen to your podcast. Give us a 5-star rating, possibly a comment, but for sure click to follow us so you never miss an episode. Most importantly, don't forget to share our episode with a friend.
And as always, if you would like to ask us a question, have a topic recommendation, or would even want to be a guest on our show, email us at addiction2recoverypodcast@gmail.com. That's addiction2recoverypodcast@gmail.com.
Or follow us on Twitter at A2RPodcast or on Facebook or Instagram at Addiction2RecoveryPodcast.